Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, and we're starting the show today by talking a little about mental health, how we can tap into the Olympic mindset. What can you and I learn from Olympians to get better at the things we do and like to do? Well, we've got an expert to share what she knows with us, Dr. Shyla Mergane, back with us once again. Dr. Mergane, a distinguished psychologist at UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health, and she's also a sports psychologist, works with the UW Badgers student athletes. So lots of experience, and it's great to have her back, and I hope you'll join in the conversation as we move along today. What experiences have you had or questions do you have? Maybe getting a little better at the things you do. Give a call, the number 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or you could send an email to talk@WPR.org. Dr. Shyla Mergane, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me, Larry.
And you're in Belize.
I am off the grid on a tiny 1 mile by 5 mile island escaping Wisconsin winter. But fortunately, there's good Wi-Fi, so we can have this conversation.
I'm really glad for that, because here we are. The 2026 Olympics they're underway in Italy. What inspires you about the world-class athletes who are now competing for medals?
There is so much excitement and awe just witnessing the potential and possibility of what human beings can accomplish. And for me as a psychologist, certainly athletes get far in physical ability alone, but really what separates those who get gold is that they have a strong mind and they actually practice training their mind. As always, I'm interested in how can we non-Olympians learn from that so we can, in a sense, go for gold in our own lives and whatever we're wanting to achieve.
So what strong mindset, that's what we're talking about here. How, what do you mean by a strong mindset? Let's put it that way.
Yeah. And I think of whether maybe at work you're needing to give a presentation, or maybe you're working on a hobby or skill that you want to excel at, or even a parent teaching their children or a grandparent wanting to instill a strong mindset in their grandchildren. There's so much to learn from Olympians. So I think one of the key things that can be a takeaway from people is Olympians learn to manage the chatter in their mind. Whenever we're trying to grow, we're growing outside the comfort zone, we're trying something new, it's easy for self-doubt and self-criticism to seep in. In a sense, our mind can focus on what's wrong or what we're not doing well enough. And in that, a lot of self-doubt can crop up. So Olympians learn to relate differently to those thoughts. I like to think of those negative thoughts like negative automatic thoughts, or the acronym NATS, flying around. And they recognize not every thought is true. It's just a thought. In a sense, they can say, hey, that's a thought, but they take action. And I think kind of in sum, they can really also, our place of personal power, which Olympians know, is just to focus on what do I need to do next? What's the next step? Those gnats can be flying around, but we don't need to get hooked with it. Instead, focus on what I need to do. And athletes also come up with maybe some positive thoughts that they can say. And in particular, thinking about instructional thoughts and inspirational thoughts. You can choose a different thought. Instructional, what do I need to do next? And then encouragement, what kinds of encouragement can I give myself in the moment to have that grit to stay on course and keep going?
You know, I was thinking about, as you were talking, I was thinking about my own experiences and the athletic things that I do. And there are, my mindset on playing golf, there are certain holes that I know darn well I'm going to do really well. I mean, I'm totally confident that I'm going to hit the ball to where I need to hit it. And then there are other holes where playing these same courses over and over again, where I'm going to have trouble with this. And so that mindset you know, I haven't conquered totally the positive mindset for every hole, but that's what Olympians do, I guess you're saying.
Yeah. And I think that's such a great example, Larry. We've all have experienced that we, in a sense, start to doubt ourselves before we even tee off at that hole. And that inner critic can, in a sense, be sticky or hook us and then derail our performance. And so I think a way to get around that is not trust every thought you think, not every thought is true, and get back to basics. So for example, Lair, if you were on the golf course wanting to excel on that particular course at that particular hole, you might use some visualization. And there's a powerful visualization practice that Olympians use, and it's called the flick back, flick forward. So you flick back in time to a time where you performed well. It might be on those other holes you did really well. Mm-hmm. You think about those characteristics that went into doing it. You visualize it if it's happening in real time. So in a sense, I think of that as a personal highlights reel. That times where you've just excelled, and then you flick forward, for example, in that hole, you haven't done historically well, you flick forward, bringing those same qualities to the upcoming task. And then you visualize yourself doing well at that hole you haven't previously, using some of those same techniques, mindset, abilities, skills in accomplishing that new goal. And so flick back to that past success, that highlights reel, and flick forward to what you want to see happen. And the best time to visualize is at bedtime, before you go to sleep, or early morning when you first wake up. That seems to go in to that subconscious mind to make it a new reality.
Interesting. Jim in Newport Township, Illinois has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Jim.
Yes, good morning. And I hope I'm not commenting too far off subject. Anyway, it has to do with in previous Olympics, I haven't noticed it so much in this particular Winter Olympics. They've shown short video biographies of the athletes. And we know that on the high school level, oftentimes they're trying to go all state. Then they graduate onto the college level and they're looking for a national ranking. But these biographies that I've seen in the past have not made any comments about their academics. And, of course, they're attending academic institutions all along the line. And so I wonder how that interplays with their actual day-to-day lives.
Yeah, that's a great question, Jim. Larry, do you have some thoughts? I have some thoughts about that.
I was, just at the non-Olympic level, I think it's often the fact, the school, the athletes, what the athlete does, where what their major is. Often I hear that.
Yeah, that's true, Larry. And it's so important. You know, I think of grandparents with their grandkids or parents with their kids. Sometimes people focus too much on one thing, like their sport. Only if they get injured or aren't, you know, they're benched for the season, then all of a sudden their identity crumbles and they can really drop pretty significantly in terms of self-esteem. So I think, Jim, what you're highlighting is the student athlete are the importance of being well-rounded. I think about it as a pyramid. If you have lots of things that define you, you're going to do better if one thing's taken away versus a pillar. You know, we certainly know these Olympians have sacrificed so much, but I think, Jim, you're highlighting the importance of other aspects like that, academics. There is life for these Olympic athletes after their sport ends, when they retire, usually pretty young. And so I think it's encouraging, to think about just in general for us to be well-rounded individuals, even if we're really trying to excel at one particular thing.
I'm thinking about self-confidence. What does a healthy level or a healthy amount of self-confidence look like?
That's great, Larry. And I think about it from a growth mindset that, you know, we all have so much more potential than we realize. And I'm always encouraging people, and especially people raising children, to focus on the potential. And with that, if we have a bad day, if we mess up, if somebody does better than us, our self-esteem isn't rocked. because we know, yeah, it was just a day, but I have tomorrow, and maybe I haven't mastered it yet. The word yet is really fundamental to the growth mindset versus the fixed mindset. People feel like I only have so much ability, and people are going to find out that maybe I'm not as good as they thought I would be. And then if you mess up, it can feel devastating because you feel like a fraud, you feel like a failure. So that growth mindset, I think, is really foundational to building confidence because, again, you're banking on what's possible versus taking too seriously what happened in a particular day.
Colleen in Cumberland sent us an email to ask, is there a connection between mental and emotional health and physical conditioning?
Absolutely. And I think, Colleen, that's why you're seeing so many Olympians really be transparent about working with a psychologist or counselor, getting mental health treatment. We've seen some high profile athletes talk about if their emotional health isn't good, they're not going to be able to perform. And I think about if you are struggling, for example, with too much anxiety, or maybe you're struggling with depression, your mind isn't going to be focused. And one of the key skills that Olympic athletes have is to be able to have laser-like focus on the task at hand and staying in the moment. And they actually train in that with mindfulness, learn how to stabilize the mind in the moment. So you're not worrying about the past or the future. And I think all of us could benefit from that to cultivate focus. And I think that's why there are people like me and others that are sports psychologists that really help athletes. I know the University of Wisconsin-Madison has prioritized that for any student athlete at any point can have access to mental health treatment for free as part of being a student. And I think you're seeing other collegiate programs doing that, and even at the high school level, and certainly at the professional level, that if we're not well, you know, we're not going to do well in our sport.
Dr. Shyla Mergain, our guest today, she is a distinguished psychologist in the Department of Orthopedics and Rehabilitation at UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health, works a lot with our UW-Madison Badger athletes as well, as we talk with her about the mindset and developing a healthy mindset is the better word to improve in whatever we do. And you can join in the number 800-642-1234. You could email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking with Dr. Shyla Mergain, distinguished psychologist at the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health, talking with her today about performance and mindset, and what are the Olympians' mindsets? I'm sure there's different mindsets for among them, but what makes them as good as they are and as successful as they are? And you can join in again, the number 800-642-1234. Can self-confidence get in the way? Well, let's put it this way. What are the signs your self-confidence may be greater than your ability to achieve a goal?
That's a great question, Larry. And I think about it as the stress and performance curve. If there's like no stress, if we're overly confident, then we're not going to necessarily work hard. We might be lackadaisical. We might not take it as seriously, only to fall short in what we're doing, versus maybe if we're underconfident, it's like there's too much stress and then we're going to have too many big event nerves. And as a result, that anxiety and tension in the body is really going to get in the way. So having the right amount of confidence, I think, is really important. And it goes back to, I think, two things: self-talk. So keeping the mind in the moment and having what I call a cue word that can really stabilize the mind, or could be an anchor. Like I think of a volleyball player who adjusts her hairband, or a golfer who adjusts the Velcro on his glove and reties it, or a baseball player who ties his shoelaces. And that kind of cue, or a word, like I've had athletes use word like focus or power or force, that kind of thing gets ourselves out of our head into the moment and focusing on what's next. And then I think secondly, recovering quickly from setbacks. Our figure skaters are great examples. You see them fall in the middle of the performance, only have to get back up with a smile on their face and focus on the next jump that they have to do. And I think that type of training, how to bounce back after a setback, I think is really important with confidence as well.
And you build it by repetition, how do you build it?
Yeah, I think a couple things. One, through effort, right? We're not going to excel overnight, and to tolerate some of those missteps along the way. So remembering that confidence is built, success is built through experience, through hard work, through effort. And when things don't go well, not taking it so seriously, but looking at it as a learning opportunity. I also think having support people along the way. The Olympians have coaches, they have teammates, they have friends and family cheering them on, that having building that support base for yourself to encourage you if you find that confidence lacking, who helps pick you up when you struggle, and who can be that cheering squad for you to keep going.
You know, yesterday I watched I'm a curling fan, so I watched the mixed doubles yesterday, and Corey Tice and Corey Dropkin were in the semifinals, and it got down to the last shot. Corey Tice, a gal from Duluth, Minnesota, had to slide that 42-pound rock 140 feet down the ice and curl it around with the help of her partner, of course, but curl it around another rock and then hit the rock kind of on the edge of the competitor, knock it out of play, and keep that other rock. You just barely touch it enough to knock it out and keep her own rock in play. And if she could do that, they win. And if she couldn't, it would go to another set and the other team would have overtime, basically, would have the advantage. So she had to make that shot basically to win, and she did it. And talk about performance under stress.
Oh my goodness, Larry, what a great example, right? And to watch that, and shout out to our Wisconsin curling community. I bet a lot of Wisconsinites, they were watching that match. And right, you're talking about what's possible, right? And in a sense, threading the needle, I think, in that. Or I think about that eye in the hurricane, that is quite quiet and calm. And so that, in that moment, she was able to really dig deep, it sounds like, stay calm, execute something probably she's practiced before, and believe in herself too. Just really heroic, inspiring performance there. And so thinking about that constructive, positive talk, looking to what might be possible, and then practicing for that moment when maybe we need to execute something in that way.
She didn't look under stress at all. I was under stress. I can tell you that.
Yeah, for sure.
Oh man, the watching that rock go all the way down and perfectly executed to win that. In fact, I think they're playing right now for the championship, for the gold.
We should all tune in. Sounds like Larry.
But that role of, I guess, positive thinking too. I mean, you got to believe you can do it. I can do this.
Absolutely. And I think what you're highlighting, Larry, we have this mental chatter going on in the background. So many of us aren't even aware of what we're saying to ourselves throughout the day. And I think what you're highlighting is we should all listen to what we're saying to ourselves throughout the day. And especially when we're trying to accomplish something during a performance or a work meeting and paying attention when those negative thoughts pop up and correcting them by consciously thinking more positive thoughts, whether it's encouragement or just instructional thoughts. And in that moment, you probably had to say, hey, I can do this, but also think through technique wise of where she needed to execute. And over time, and I think this is a big thing we know from neuroscience, over time, interrupting those negative thoughts and replacing them with more constructive ones will have a real effect on our performance and overall outlook.
And I think, you know, she was probably in some kind of zone. We, you know, we talk about, you hear this athletes say, oh, I was in the zone. What can you do to reproduce that experience? I mean, I hear this a lot from many different kinds of athletes. So I was in
absolutely. Mm-hmm. And you're going to see athletes prior to competition doing slower, lower breathing or listening to music to regulate physiologically. If you're too keyed up or too sluggish, you're not going to perform well. And athletes know the right physiological and emotional state, and they train in accessing it so they can turn it on like a light switch. And we can all do that. Larry, for almost any athlete that I work with, I encourage them to do a 4-6 breath count, doing diaphragmatic breathing or belly breathing. So breathing in for 4 and then out for 6. And doing that, I call it the power 10 breath. So doing that for 10 breaths. So again, you're breathing in for 4, your stomach's going out like a balloon filling with air. As you breathe out, you're breathing out for 6, and that stomach like a balloon is deflating, and doing that for 10 breaths. That 4-6 breath count for at least 10 breaths really seems to be helpful in regulating physiologically. And then I'm always encouraging my athletes to practice more of that breathing, you know, up to 20 minutes a day over time can really make a difference. Wow. And it's helpful for lowering blood pressure and lowering anxiety too, and helps with sleep. So there are physical benefits too, just for our overall health.
As you were talking, I did it twice.
I can only get two.
Great,
Larry.
I can only get two.
Even 2 breaths can be helpful. Yeah. And that's just as helpful whether we're going into a presentation or a tough conversation or waiting in the doctor's waiting area. You know, that kind of breathing really balances our stress response and creates more equilibrium in our system.
Amy from Milwaukee wonders is mindfulness training useful when a person is applying or maybe has gotten a new job?
Absolutely. I think that can be one of the most tiring things if you're starting a new job the first 6 months, or it can be one of the most anxiety provoking situations in life if we're out of work trying to find new work. I think about using mindfulness in a job interview, just really staying present and also in touch with our qualities. It can help us just manage stress of starting a new job, or it can even provide some motivation just in applying for a job. So something simple like using your breath and just spending even 5 minutes of just noticing the breath as you're breathing in and out, and using the breath as an anchor to focus on. Or you could do a 5 senses practice. For example, when you're walking, noticing 5 things you see, 4 things you hear, 3 things you can touch, 2 things you smell, 1 thing you taste. Again, that gets us out of our head into the moment. So we're connected with more of life. And I think also more of us shows up when we're just here now in the moment, present.
Yeah. Thinking in terms of long-term versus short-term. Here I'm thinking about the when I've been in an interviewing mode where you're 3 or 4 people interviewing somebody for a position, often the question comes up, where do you want to be 4 years from now or 5 years from now? And for a lot of Olympians, it's kind of the same because the Olympics only happen every 4 years. So there's long-term goals for them, but there's also often long-term goals for us.
Yes, Larry.
So it's important to have long-term as well as short-term.
Absolutely. I think it's really enlivening. And part of how we have vitality in our life is by building meaning and purpose. And I think Olympians, you know, they're working for a 4-year goal, if not longer. Maybe they've been doing this sport since childhood. And I think that can be really inspiring to think about not just what I want to do this year, but start setting and working towards long-term goals and really incorporating some of these mental skills we've been working on. And I think that can help us really chart our course. I think about it as steering by starlight, that 4-year goal that allows us to stay on track with our career, our life, our family, what's important, but also to allow us to experience and achieve more of what we want for ourselves. So yeah. I encourage people to set maybe 4-year goals for the next Winter Olympics, or even 2 for the Summer Olympics.
And what happens, I'm thinking there's only one winner oftentimes, and sometimes in your job, things happen, your results are disappointing, didn't turn out the way you wanted. What strategies are there to recovering from that, maybe a loss or setback?
Mm-hmm. I think two, number one, right, there's only one gold, right? And we forget that for Olympians, every moment is part of being in the Olympics, walking out in that opening ceremony, flying over to Italy. And sometimes we get so focused on the outcome, I need to win, I need to achieve, that we forget that sometimes the whole experience is part of it. And second, sometimes we learn more from failure than achievement. And there's something called, you know, growth from that, that difficult thing. Can be sometimes that silver lining is what we need to focus on, that maybe it didn't work out today, but maybe it will tomorrow. And even if it doesn't, maybe there's some other lesson there that I'm learning that I can apply in ways to help others or benefit me in some other aspect down the road. And that's really, in the end, what it was about. And that's something to maybe work on being okay with and learn from and accept and then move forward.
Well, I don't know if Corey Dropkin are going to win that curling match today, but they were guaranteed a silver. So that's that's another way to look at it, I think, for in our own lives, too. You know, all right,
yeah,
I've still got my job. I've still got, you know, I learned from what I did that didn't turn out well, and I'm going to apply myself in other ways to make that to make that break and make that improvement. Shyla, it's a pleasure talking with you today, all the way from Belize. I've been there, and it's a nice place. Let's put it that way. And you're in a good place, mentally, too. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Larry. Always a joy. Appreciate it.
Shyla Morgane, a psychologist at UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health, a sports psychologist to the UW Badger athletes. Up next, we're going to talk about how a UW improv class for students pursuing careers in healthcare can help them be better doctors. And Amy Zielinski is the instructor from UW School of Medicine and Public Health, and she will be our guest coming right up. I'm Larry Mueller. Enjoy improv comedy. I kind of like it, and I've had a chance to do it once or twice with mixed success. But could you imagine taking an improv class to get better at a serious job, like being a doctor or a nurse? The UW School of Medicine and Public Health offers an improv class, and we're going to talk about that with the associate professor who teaches it, and her name, Amy Zielinski, a medical education researcher, associate professor of medicine in the UW School of Medicine. It's great to have Amy Zielinski with us. Amy, welcome, by the way.
Thank you so much. It's wonderful to be here with you, Larry.
Oh, man. It's great to have you here. And as you listen to Amy, I hope you'll join in. Maybe you've received some training to improve your interpersonal skills at work. Would you like to take an improv class to learn how to make, maybe have more empathy toward other people? I think that's part of the goal here. Give a call, the number 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. How did you come, Amy, to teach a class on improvisational theater for students pursuing a degree in healthcare?
Yeah, so I really started my career working with medical residents, and we were teaching them how to deliver difficult news. So a patient has a new cancer diagnosis, or unfortunately they have a recurrence. And as I was working with these residents, I realized that they could perform as we would want them to. They could say the words, but they really were struggling with the connection piece, and they really cared so deeply about their patients. But they felt like if they cared too much, they would no longer be an effective physician. And so I started to understand this as empathy, as a skill that most of us have. But when you go into a profession where you're faced with a lot of suffering, you have to learn how to flex it, how to use it a little bit more intentionally. And I'm a former actor, and I realized that I learned those skills through acting. So that kind of led me down the path to think, how could I use theater and improv as the most accessible form of theater to help folks learn these skills?
Because you were teaching students about this, but you hadn't started out. You just thought, suddenly, why not an improv class?
Yeah. And luckily, there was a woman named Katie Watson at Northwestern who was doing this before me. And uh-huh. So I was able to go and learn from her, and Belinda Fu, who's at Washington State. And I also had some support from a student who came to me and said, you know, I think people are doing this around the country. Maybe we could do it here. And then Liz Petty, who's our associate dean over at the medical school, was also very supportive. So I had support from all ends, and I said, hey, let's try this out.
So how does improv help students develop empathy?
So the core tenets of improv, so we think about improv, like you mentioned, we think about it as comedy sports or Second City. Its roots are actually from the Hull House in Chicago. So Jane Addams hired a social worker named Neva Boyd to work with children at the Hull House. And Neva started using these techniques to get children to relate to each other, to work together, to hear each other. And Viola Spolin took those from the Hull House, those activities, to the theater, and that's what we call improv. So at its core, improv is really about connection, about listening, about really listening and not just thinking about what we're going to say next, which I think is really difficult for us.
Yeah. And I think empathy is defined as the imaginative reconstruction of another's perspective and the emotional resonance this causes in the self.
Yeah. So I think sometimes we think about it as putting ourselves in other shoes, but I think that's limiting. Because really, in order for me to understand your experience, I need to imagine what it might be like to be you. And it might be very different from my own experience.
So these classes, it's improv. But there must be, are there topics that are, you know, sort of drummed up or that you have thought through in advance that you
do
with the students, or how do you do it?
So the first class is really kind of foundational. So there are certain rules of improv, like many people have probably heard the rule of saying yes and. So we go through those rules. We practice doing that. We practice not asking questions. I know that for an interviewer, that's probably a hard rule to think about. Mm-hmm. One of the rules is to try to not ask questions. And then as we go further in the class, we focus on verbal communication, nonverbal communication, and can we kind of parse it out that way? Because as a course, you want to make sure that folks are taking things away and learning specific content. But what we create in the class is purely improvised. It exists for that moment and is gone forever.
So it's not necessarily a health topic that somebody throws out, or is it so anybody in the class throws out an idea?
Yeah, exactly. And sometimes it's health related and sometimes it's not. We kind of just go with it. We say yes and.
Well, and and you've done some research on this too.
Yeah, exactly. So thinking about, you know, part of what I enjoy about being in academia is the ability to ask research questions. And when I started to see learners really learn from these activities, I wanted to know how and why and what it was that they were learning. So we started to do some research. My research focus is on empathy and communication in healthcare, so I really focused on those domains. And we found that after a, you know, 6-week course, students were able to increase their empathic abilities, which unfortunately, when folks come into medicine, they tend to be really high in empathy. And then as they go through training, that declines. So I was interested in finding ways that we could keep that higher and learn, help them learn how to manage that empathy in this new setting. And improv seems to be a really valuable tool.
So I noticed that research that in the research that empathy goes down the longer you're in the you know, learning to become a doctor or physician. And why?
Yeah. There's a lot of different ideas about why that might be. I, as a medical educator, take some responsibility for that. I think we have our students and our residents focusing so much on the medical knowledge, on the patient care, which is very important. But then sometimes my students in my class will say, you know, I've forgotten who I am. I am all of a sudden becoming this physician, but I've lost so many parts of myself. And I think that we can't ask people to engage in empathy with others if they're not really help fully themselves and can be authentic with those patients.
Yeah, and I was thinking about the structure of medicine these days is much different than it probably was when I was a kid. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
My Dr. Schoenbeck would sit down and talk to me about all kinds of things. And I have a great doctor now, Jim Sossman, and he'll take the time just because we've kind of been together for like 30 years.
Yeah.
It's a lot of lots of conversations that he and I have had over time. But I even see it in him. Or other doctors, actually, they're... There's a lot of paperwork.
There's
a lot of need to, I think, to move patients along.
Yeah, the system is overrun. I mean, we have a lot of patients and not much time to spend with them. So they have a lot of pressures on them. The, you know, technology has made our lives so much better in so many ways. But with the electronic medical record, there's a lot more demands on their time. A lot of things that take them away from those conversations that they really love having with their patients.
Yeah. Amy Zielinski, our guest today, medical education researcher and associate professor of medicine at UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Questions for her or maybe an experience to share? That'd be cool, too, if you've got one that was good or maybe not good. I hope you'll join in. The number 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. How difficult is it for healthcare students to learn to listen to their patients?
I think some of it is about unlearning. So trying to sort of take all of those things that they've learned and these question sets that they know that they need to ask in order to make a diagnosis, know that they've got that, and then start to work on this other skill of really just being present with the patient and that and have the confidence that they're going to ask that next question even after they listen to their patient with real intention.
Yeah, that's hard to do sometimes, I think.
Yeah.
I'm in the business, here we're in the business of talking with people and interviewing them for shows, and sometimes I'll even find myself thinking about the next question I'm going to ask rather than listening to what the person is telling me.
Yeah, and so...
And I've been doing it a while.
Right. So when you're in an improv scene in front of other people, that's a real liability because you realize, oh, no, I'm stuck. I did not listen to what my partner was telling me. So I need to do better and really engage and really listen to my partner. Because improv, at the heart of it, is really about your making your partner look good. It's not necessarily about yourself. So if you're not listening to them and really adding to the contributions that they're providing, then you're not successful. You're not doing your job. And you feel that. And so some of that, like your last guest was saying, you know, being able to recover from setbacks in an improv class, you have many, many setbacks in a two-hour class. And so it's a great opportunity to build that resilience.
Yeah, I imagine there are many. How does it really go? I mean, by the end, are people much more accomplished than they? I mean, it's got to be probably a range of abilities to begin with.
Yeah, absolutely. But I would say we meet 6 weeks, by the third class, people are really hitting their stride. Even the folks that were very hesitant to come to class, to take the class, they're really starting to get into it, to listen, to feel successful, to know that they're going to have something to contribute at the end. Even when they're listening to their partner, they can have that confidence that they're going to be successful in that situation. And then they bring back stories from how they've used this in their real life as well.
Oh, so that it works in other places too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we were talking earlier about, I've just mentioned in passing, I think, interviewing for jobs. And I thought, in your research, there was some feedback on that.
Yeah. Medical students in their fourth year of medical school are interviewing for residency positions. So many students who were in my class last fall mentioned how helpful it was in their interviews to have this idea of yes and to just build on what their interviewers were asking them to keep the conversation going. And it really helped them build confidence and appear confident to their interviewers as well.
So somebody said, what's this yes and business I'm getting here? And
yeah.
go ahead and explain that a bit more.
So often when we're in a conversation, maybe not often, but sometimes when we're in a conversation, we're going back and forth and we're using maybe a yes, but. So we're having a conversation and I agree with you a little bit, but I want you to hear this other point of view. And sometimes we're arguing and that answer is no. So we're arguing back and forth. So in improv, we have to build this yes and muscle. So whatever you contribute, whatever you say, I'm going to say yes and. So I'm going to agree and I'm going to offer something of my own as well.
I I'm not going to name any names here, but I once worked with a guy who was involved in some UW things, and there was going to be a meeting. And he said, well, here's what I'd like, how I'd like this meeting, this point, and this point passed. And it was a group of people who were not happy about a lot of things. And I watched him in action because he came in and people immediately started to complain. And he said, I'm with you on this. This is... the issue, and he's agreeing with them, and then we went on to other things, and then in the end, the 3 points that he wanted to get across and have action in his favor were all happily approved by everybody there. I saw him do that sort of thing more than once, and it was really cool skill to have.
Yeah, absolutely. We walk into rooms and, you know, you can imagine clinicians walk into rooms all the time where people are upset. They've been waiting. They don't want to be there in the first place. So having this ability to take that on and transform it into something positive is really, really helpful.
Yeah. Tim and Madison, what's on your mind?
Hey, good afternoon. So I wanted to ask you about empathy of nonverbal communication based on people's behavior and their fitness when they come in for a medical exam. So, for instance, people get vital signs taken and they're sitting in a chair and they often don't move out of the chair at all, or they just move over to a table. But what about looking at having them walk and checking their gait or doing simple fitness tests like grip strength or the to stand from a chair. So my question is, how are physicians learning to be empathetic based on observations of movement?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think in my class and in what I teach, we often will talk about just making sure that you're meeting the patient where they are. And in order to know where they are, you have to have some data. And so if that data that's important is how they're moving around, then absolutely getting in there, doing these different techniques and exams, really relating to them physically. I think there's so much that we can find out, like you're saying, with blood tests or from the medical record, but we really still need to know each other and how their bodies are working. So I think that's a really important point.
And as Tim started to talk, I was thinking about it from totally the other end, the other extreme is that you're I'm the doctor. And so my own nonverbal communication, talk about that a bit. Is that part of the course?
Yeah. And I think one of the interesting things about improv is that it brings out things that are our habits that we might not even be aware of. So we have interactions in the class, and then we can kind of take them apart and debrief about them. And what was that like? And what did you notice? And what did the audience notice? And people can start to realize how they're coming across non-verbally to other people as well, which is a huge part of empathy, because that's how we're being seen by the other person. So we need to be aware of that.
And looking people in the eye and...
Very important. There's cultural differences with eye contact.
Yeah.
But so, you know, we talk about that a lot in class and how to navigate that. But I think in our culture, for, you know, generally, that's something that we practice and talk about.
Are there other professions that could benefit from improv, you think?
I think so. I think so. And it's been used in a lot of different professions in the business world and at the law school. I know that they're doing some things. So I think that a lot of other professions are starting to catch on. Social work, it grew up in social work, and folks in social work still use it, or counseling. And I think just in daily life, sometimes my students will tell me, you know, these skills helped me have a better conversation with my brother, who I haven't talked to in a while. So I think they're just very transferable skills.
You've heard some feedback from former students. I'm wondering, and you mentioned some non-medical, I think, instances, but what about students sharing their experiences based on practicing with patients?
Yeah, I think one of the things that comes across is this ability to show up and to have confidence in your ability to help people. So unfortunately, some of our physicians, you know, they're with people at the end of life when they don't have any more medical answers or treatments for them. And they come back to me and say, you know, doing some of the improv or helping me build those skills helped me be present with them and realize that my presence and my ability to be there with them was therapeutic and was what I could offer in the moment, which is really hard for physicians because, you know, they want to make people better, and sometimes that's just not an option.
That's not going to happen. And I've had both ends of that spectrum in my own life over time, where I had a very sort of offhand remark about the death of the coming death of a child, and then I had on the other end of that a doctor who sat down with us and was really empathetic. And thankfully, undid a lot of what the first person caused in the way of grief and so forth.
Well, thank you for sharing that example. I think it's so important. I think sometimes we think of empathy and communication as additional skills that clinicians need to know, but that's an example of how you can do harm with your communication. And so I think it's essential.
Well, I am glad you're teaching this class because I think... I wish every med student had to take it, to be perfectly honest. Oh my gosh, it's been really enlightening and fun, Amy. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Larry. It's been a joy to be here.
Amy Zielinski, a medical education researcher and associate professor of medicine at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, and coming up, we're going to continue with our medical. We're talking about talking with a doctor who sometimes probably has to give some advice that he doesn't want to give relating to pancreatic cancer. That'll be next. We'll take a look at pancreatic cancer with our guest, Dr. Jeremy Kratz. I'm Larry Mueller. Great to have you along here on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, turning our attention to pancreas cancer. It's projected to be the second leading cause of cancer deaths. May not come to pass, possibly as a result of clinical trials at the UW Health Carbone Cancer Center, where they're working to improve detection and treatment. And we're going to talk about that and more about pancreatic cancer with our guest, Dr. Jeremy Kratz, back with us. He was with us a couple years back, I believe, to talk about this, but back again. He's an assistant professor in the Division of Hematology, Medical Oncology, and Palliative Care within the Department of Medicine of UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Kratz is also a physician scientist at the UW Health Carbone Cancer Center. So do you have someone in your family or you yourself been diagnosed with pancreas cancer? Questions about it? I hope you will join the conversation. The number to call, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Dr. Jeremy Kratz, welcome back. Thank you for taking time to be with us today. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you so much, Larry, for having me on today. It's, it's really an important time. We often think about August as Pancreas Cancer Awareness Month, but it's really important to have a reminder kind of 6 months or kind of into that next year.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's do some basics here. What's the job of the pancreas in the human body?
Yeah, the pancreas makes a lot of different enzymes that help us break down food. Specifically breaking down proteins and fats is the primary role, but there's a secondary role in the pancreas, and that's making insulin and controlling blood sugar levels. So, historically, the pancreas has played a role in primarily in digestion. That said, it is possible to survive without a pancreas, but it comes with significant lifestyle changes if, for example, our surgeons were to remove the entire pancreas.
So, and pancreatic cancer, I guess there's different forms of it, but what's happening with it? I mean, what goes on?
Yeah, so pancreas cancer, generally the most common cause is where the lining of the duct of the pancreas develops a cancer. We call that adenocarcinoma is the fancy term, but that's the most serious form of pancreas cancer that we see. Sometimes there are neuroendocrine cells that are a different type that can also form a cancer, and that is truly pancreas cancer. But in general, the neuroendocrine variants are less aggressive. But the challenge with pancreas cancer isn't necessarily always the initial start within the pancreas, but unfortunately, this cancer can spread. It can metastasize, and that's where it becomes more serious and more aggressive.
And I was thinking back to a friend of mine who went in for, he had to get a physical because he was getting some more life insurance, and he was perfectly, I thought, healthy, and he thought he was perfectly healthy, and they said, well, you got stage 4 pancreas cancer.
Mm-hmm. Terrible diagnosis.
And so he lived another 7-8 months, something like that. But he went from looking the peak of health to death in a relatively short period of time.
I'm so sorry to hear that, Larry. I think, you know, sometimes what cancer takes away from our patients is the hardest thing. You know, the strength, the day-to-day things that it can take away sometimes are the hardest things and the things that we want to preserve when we talk about treating this cancer. But thanks so much for sharing about your friend. You can tell that it still hits you a little bit.
Oh, sure.
Just from our conversation here.
Yeah, and he was in his 40s. I'm wondering about the age on pancreas cancer. I mean, typically, I assume it would develop later in life, but
yeah, traditionally it would. The median patient would present sometime in their 60s. But that said, there are individuals that we see in our clinics that can present in their 30s and their 40s, which, you know, I think opens a question to why. And I think that's where a lot of our works in genomics and the tissue microenvironment in the research laboratory, they're really looking to ask the question of why did this happen and how can we help identify individuals potentially at higher individual risk for developing these cancers. You know, we think that, you know, everyone, because society is living longer these days, has a higher risk for cancer across time. And so developing strategies to monitor patients with high-risk lesions, and also being in tune and having a good relationship with your primary care doctor is a big part of overall health in general, as well as in the early detection of cancer. If something's new, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's cancer, but working with your primary care physician is really important. And them knowing you is part of that continuity that supersedes the care that we provide in the cancer clinic. It really starts with the primary care physicians.
You know, I mentioned the one friend, but I've been friends with three other people who also passed away from it. And I'm wondering the incidence of it. I mean, what percentage of the population comes down with it, so to speak?
Yeah. So in general, this is a rare cancer. It does affect, you know, a few kind of a handful of individuals for every 100,000 in terms of absolute incidence. The challenge is that unfortunately, a majority of patients, you know, may die from this cancer. And that's what makes it so difficult, you know, in terms of its prognosis.
And you mentioned genes, and I'm assuming if you have family history of it, it's probably a concern. At least a couple members probably in your family.
Yep, approximately 10% of individuals can carry a family risk factor for pancreas cancer. Our national guidelines recommend that anyone who is diagnosed with pancreas cancer that they get a blood test to evaluate for what we call a germline or a hereditary cause for this cancer. And so, you know, our hope is that as time goes on, that we can help prevent this in individuals who, say, have family risk factors and potentially have early lesions that could be identified and could be acted on. Now, that requires a lot of coordination. It requires, you know, being proactive in that. But for that reason, UW Health has a pancreas cancer prevention clinic, which is used to identify high-risk individuals, their families, and is there to really be on the preventative side of this disease.
You can join in with your own questions and comments as we move along with our guest, Dr. Jeremy Kratz, physician scientist at the University of Wisconsin-Carbone Cancer Center. It's great to have him with us. Number to call, 800-642-1234. You can email us to talk@wpr.org. Dave in Spring Valley has something for us. Let's go there. Dave, hi. Thank you for calling. Dave, are you there?
Hi. I'm here.
Yep. Yeah, go ahead.
So my wife was recently diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, and we went through a number of tests, and they found that it had not spread yet, but the tumor had kind of shut off the vagus vein that I guess is in that neighborhood, and the oncologist said that the only cure that she has seen from pancreatic cancer with it involves surgery. She checked with Connections in Mayo Clinic in Rochester, and they said that the surgery is too risky because there's blood vessels that basically went around this stoppage, mm-hmm. and there's too high a risk for bleeding if they try to do surgery. So anyway, she's just started. She's got one chemotherapy session under her belt and another one a week after next. So anyway, I just wanted to get your comments and any thoughts on that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, first off, thanks so much for sharing, this story. I think that there's a lot of anatomical considerations for this cancer. The hard part is that the blood vessels and the veins that drain the intestinal system, specifically the mesenteric artery and the mesenteric veins, these blood vessels, as well as the portal vein, which is involved in the blood supply to the liver, all of these are really important to maintain the digestive functions of the body. And so, I can't really speak in great detail for, this individual case. But what I can say is that the anatomy is very important and should be reviewed in a multidisciplinary fashion that includes input from the surgeons, the medical oncologists, the pathologists, and the radiation oncologists. As a team, we have kind of an intake tumor board where we basically review every individual case with input from multiple oncologists, multiple surgeons, our radiology teams, and our radiation oncologists. And we think that is kind of the team-based approach that provides our patients a comprehensive view. And, at UW, I can say that we oftentimes have consensus. We work together to provide a patient the clearest path that's not based upon the opinion of an individual, but rather is based upon, the thoughts of our team together. I think that unfortunately, while surgery can control this cancer, if surgery was possible, there would remain an extremely high risk that the cancer could spread or metastasize. And that's true of all stages of pancreatic cancer, which is why within our practices, we've been starting with systemic treatment or chemotherapy if an individual is safe for that treatment plan. So if a patient, has the appropriate health conditions, we oftentimes start with IV chemotherapy in order to, one, kill any cancer cells if they are in the bloodstream already, and two, try and shrink the cancer down in order to reconsider any local treatment options. For example, there are individuals who are more sensitive to chemotherapy, and sometimes in those scenarios, we can decrease the size of the tumor and potentially improve the involvement of the cancer so that it's not right up against or surrounding some of the vasculature. Now, sometimes in these scenarios, we can just achieve stable disease where the cancer remains kind of in place. And that's where oftentimes we use radiation treatments to try and sterilize the local environment of where the cancer is. in general, radiation is better tolerated than surgery in terms of the recovery time. And we have had individuals in our practices that have had kind of durable benefit to radiation treatments. And there are some new technologies about the ways that radiation are given that also need to be kind of reviewed. There's different doses and different numbers of fractions or proportions of that that also are part of that planning, which is a very nuanced view, but is something that we definitely try to provide that opinion back in the context of that initial visit. So when we meet with a patient, it's not just meeting with a surgeon. We generally prefer to have a patient meet with all the healthcare providers kind of on that same day in order to have kind of a finalized plan.
Mm. Dave, I really appreciate your call here and your story. Thank you so much for being with us, and I hope Dr. Kratz's response is helpful. Thank you very much. Dr. Jeremy Kratz, Assistant Professor in the Division of Hematology at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, and Physician Scientist at UW's Carbone Cancer Center. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks so much for joining in today. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Dr. Jeremy Kratz, Assistant Professor in the Division of Hematology, Medical Oncology, and Palliative Care at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, also a physician scientist at the University of Wisconsin Carbone Cancer Center. I had a chance several times to interview Dr. Paul Carbone many years back, and it was always an interesting, and he was quite an individual. I'd say that for sure. And a lot of things have changed over that period, probably 30 years ago when I talked with him anyway, in terms of improvement in cancer. We're talking about pancreas cancer, and certainly there have been the results, once you have it, aren't always good, but there has been a lot of work here at the University of Wisconsin campus by Dr. Kratz and many, many others, as he was talking about, the whole team working on how we can have early detection and maybe be able to extend the lives of many people who suffer from it. Mike in Viroqua has a comment or question, perhaps. Let's go there. Mike, thank you for calling.
Good morning, Larry. Good morning, Dr. Kratz. I'm a family doctor in Viroqua. And if you're familiar with the area, our population isn't very large out here. But as a matter of interest, between November of 2024 and January of 2025, I had four patients diagnosed with pancreatic cancer in that short span of time. Two were in their 60s and two were in their 70s. And that has to be one of the greatest statistical anomalies in medicine.
Yeah. Go ahead, Dr. Kratz.
Yeah. I mean, it's so hard because, there is, a large amount of variance in terms of what we see. I guess I would say that at least in the clinic side, we oftentimes see that more patients present around kind of the end of the year, or the holiday season, potentially maybe because there are more social interactions or longitudinal social interactions where families kind of reengage. And I think that kind of represents the importance of kind of a well-connectedness that occurs, within kind of individual communities. And I think that's an important point, is that so often we think about this as stochastically, rare or, something that happens in isolation. But I would argue that the communities that we care for, have opportunities to be very well connected. For example, the University of Wisconsin has a pancreatic cancer task force, which has, a lot of resources for individuals who are newly diagnosed. We have peer support systems. We have kind of a lot of resources that exist. And there are other groups, including PanCAN or the Pancreas Cancer Foundations nationally, that take some of these kind of rare cases or isolated individuals and allow them to really come together as a community. And we think that that's incredibly important, particularly in settings where individuals don't have a lot of individual support. I'm sorry to hear that within your practice, and for each individual and in every family. But I do think that if, someone on this call is listening in about pancreas cancer, it's important to know that there are resources in oncology. We're here to share in that. I'd like to believe that oncologists are partners in this journey, and we're here to support our patients, to offload some of that uncertainty, provide guidance about what things are ahead, and provide some guidance about, of course, the risks and benefits of the things that our patients consider.
Yeah. Well, it brings to mind, we've talked genetics as a factor, but are there environmental circumstances? Brian in Manitowoc is a recovering alcoholic. He assumes he's at a higher risk for pancreatic cancer due to his prior alcohol use, and wondering about the relationship between alcoholism and pancreatic cancer. And I might add just other kinds of environmental issues that may take maybe issues.
So certainly the use of alcohol and tobacco can change the local environment. It can lead to higher incidence of spontaneous mutations that occur within those cells, but also it can change the local environment. For example, if someone has the healthy pancreas that is damaged from the stress and the inflammation that happens from alcohol, those cells, are driven in a way where they have to kind of regenerate or heal themselves. And so, in some ways, there's kind of two dualities that occur in cancer. One is tissue regeneration, which is the ability for tissue to kind of grow back. And then the other is for the immune system to recognize those cells as, say, growing too quickly or growing unchecked. And so this idea of the immune system is critically important, especially because so many cancers have seen advances where we can use the immune system to kill cancer cells directly. We certainly think that's going to be kind of the future of where we're going, and certainly some trials that we have open at the Carbone Cancer Center right now are working hard to bring immune cells that can kill cancer cells directly in contact with them. Currently, we have two active clinical trials for advanced stage disease, including one for locally advanced disease, where we basically can bring immune cells in direct contact with the cancer cells.
Yeah. Greg in Belvedere, Illinois, we'll give you a chance to join in. Thank you for calling.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the time. Before I actually start, I want to apologize in advance for what might sound like anger and frustration in my voice. I'm a former Illinois resident. First wife and I got divorced. I met another lady in my travels down in South Georgia. We married. Was married for 32 years, and 1 year she started losing weight, was having digestive problems. Her primary caregiver tried medication. Nothing was working. She sent her to a gastrointestinal doctor. They did two endoscopies, tried treating it with drugs, did a colonoscopy. This went on back and forth with the doctors for nearly 18 months before somebody finally put two and two together and decided to test for pancreatic cancer, which by then it was too late. Now, I had never even heard of pancreatic cancer until my wife got it. After she passed away 2 years ago, I started talking to people at work who had lost relatives to it. And the pattern seems to be the same. It's doctor, doctor, doctor for a year, year and a half, before they finally, somebody finally tests for pancreatic cancer. And by then it's too late.
Yeah. So what is, yeah. So why, I guess, is what Greg's saying. Why can't people, or why can't the medical facility or the doctors test earlier?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, I'd like to, you know, believe, Greg, that your story is, you know, in isolation. Oftentimes in medical oncology, we are involved after a diagnosis. And so, you know, I think that traditionally the scan that can make this diagnosis is either a CAT scan or an MRI. You're absolutely right that things like chronic diarrhea, new abdominal or back pain, those are definitely hallmark signs, as well as new onset diabetes. Someone who never had diabetes in their life and in their 50s or 60s spontaneously develops diabetes, that's been shown to be a risk factor for developing pancreas cancer. And so all of that should definitely be reviewed with an individual's primary care provider or with a gastroenterologist. Both of them are critical in working up, you know, the constellation of symptoms that you describe. As far as, you know, why in that individual case, I really don't have an immediate answer for that. I think that it is important that, you know, we are advocates for our patients. It's important that patients and families are advocates for, you know, for one another. I think red flags include weight loss. I think, you know, persistent pain that is not improving. All of those things have to certainly be considered. I really think that this is where partnering with a primary care physician across time is critically important to say, my weight has always been here, and all of a sudden I've lost 40 pounds, or I've lost 10% of my weight without changing anything about what else has been happening. I think those are all very fair and important questions. And I would just encourage that individuals have good relationships with primary care, because really that is where the clinical diagnosis occurs. And then, you know, if an individual isn't getting the answers that they want, I also think it's important to, you know, to consider a second opinion. And that would probably be through the role of a gastroenterologist. So a provider who focuses on digestive health issues, they are critical, and they oftentimes are the ones that do make a tissue-based diagnosis where they can do a procedure to go into the stomach and into the small intestine and sample an area of the pancreas. That ultimately is done by an interventional gastroenterologist.
Greg, I'm sorry for your loss, and I thank you very much for calling and sharing your thoughts. Lauren in Madison, your turn. Hi, Lauren.
Hi, Larry. Thank you for hosting this show. Dr. Kratz, I want to thank you for the shout-out to the Pancreas Cancer Task Force. I'm a member of that task force, and I know that all of the members who are listening right now very much appreciate the partnership and collaboration that we have with the Carbone Cancer Center and all the people that work there. So thank you. My question is about KRAS. My wife is a cancer survivor. She had the Whipple surgery, radiation, chemotherapy. She's about 15 years out from the surgery. One of the things that we learned over the last 15 years through our own experience with the cancer and through the Pancreas Cancer Task Force is the importance of this gene KRAS and how KRAS can play a role in identification and treatment. What is the Carbone Cancer Center doing to capitalize on this research and this knowledge about KRAS? Thank you.
And, yeah, absolutely.
And may I, maybe you could explain KRAS for us too, Dr. Kratz.
Yeah. So the way I think about KRAS is it's kind of like a spark plug. It's basically a pro-oncogene. It's something that helps the cancer cells grow. But it's something that the cancer can kind of go to at any point in time because it's kind of the spark plug that can kind of reignite continuously to lead to the cell's growth and proliferation. KRAS can be mutated or activated in greater than 80, oftentimes even 90% of the time KRAS is mutant, which is why we focused a lot of efforts both in translational research and in clinical trials in order to block the signaling of KRAS. There are many different ways to block the signaling of KRAS, and that wasn't true even 3 years ago. 3 years ago, we kind of waited for KRAS to spark, and then we tried to block its downstream pathways. Whereas nowadays, we actually have the ability to block KRAS and also block the interactions that KRAS has with other proteins. And so recently, the FDA had prioritized, I believe it was 9 agents, and one of them is actually a drug from a group called Revolution Medicine that actually blocks many of the isoforms of KRAS. And so the FDA has kind of chosen this agent for an accelerated development process. And so, you know, we are hopeful that the research around this agent and other KRAS inhibitors can kind of provide a launch board to get these in the hands of patients sooner. Right now, I can say at Carbone, within the last 12 months, we've had at least 4 and likely up to 6, even more than that. We've had probably 6 or 7 clinical trials that have focused on different ways of blocking KRAS. The challenge is that, for a given trial, you know, we're trying to offer this treatment for any patient who's eligible. And because there's so much enthusiasm for developing these agents, these trials are somewhat challenging to find the slot. They're very competitive. And so, at our cancer center, we are competing with the large cancer centers, the MD Andersons, the Sloan Ketterings of the world, in order to make sure that our patients here in Wisconsin are offered these agents. And so, it is something where if we're presented with an opportunity to consider a KRAS trial, particularly in a space where, you know, where we see evidence of activity in other models or in relevant animal studies, we accept that trial immediately, provided that, you know, we have safe guardrails for considering that for our patients. So unlike other disease etiologies where, you know, we may consider 1 or 2 trials, if it's a KRAS trial, we're raising our hand and saying, yes, let's bring this for the patients that we treat. And that's critically important. And we also review regional clinical trials as well to see if there's other slots. But oftentimes, we have kind of matches where patients can be matched based upon a given variant. So with the kind of the flavor of the KRAS variant, we oftentimes have trials that are available for those patients. As an example, we currently have 2 clinical trials that are targeting KRAS G12D. We had 1 clinical trial that was targeting all of KRAS. We, in the last 12 months, have participated in 3 clinical trials that targeted KRAS G12C, which is just an amino acid substitution. But I'm getting a little technical here to say that it's kind of all court press to block the signaling of KRAS.
Yeah. Thank you again for calling. Appreciate your call. Pat in Middleton, your turn.
Yeah, hey, thanks for taking my call. Really interesting. My son had severe pancreatitis when he was in his mid-20s. Ended up hospital several days on the ventilator with adult respiratory distress syndrome, and he recovered completely and is, you know, doing all the right things now. And I think it may have been partly alcohol related, but he's now 40 and very healthy. My question is whether or not that severe episode of pancreatitis would predispose him to pancreatic cancer later in life, and if so, did he have any screening, such as, you know, abdominal ultrasounds done on a regular basis to detect it early?
It's a great question. I think that there's a lot of variables that play into it. We know from studies of individuals who have chronic pancreatitis, which would be kind of recurring episodes that occur multiple times, that they certainly have elevated individual risks across time for developing cancer, pancreas cancer specifically. The challenge is that if this was one single isolated event that occurred, it may not meet that criteria for chronic pancreatitis. Instead, you know, it could be a spell of what we call acute pancreatitis, which is where in a short period of time, someone has inflammation of the pancreas. And so the definition and the timeline of that can impact the likelihood of this conferring this individual to have a higher long-term risk. And so, unfortunately, there's limited evidence for a single isolated acute or short-term presentation that would increase an individual's risk. I do think it's a fair discussion, and I think that the risk-benefit of surveillance is one that likely could occur in coordination with our pancreas prevention clinic that is focused on ways of preventing pancreatic cancer.
Pat, thank you again for calling. Appreciate it. Dr. Jeremy Kratz, our guest today, physician scientist at the UW Carbone Cancer Center, talking with him about pancreas cancer. Great to have him with us. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Looking at pancreas cancer today with Dr. Jeremy Kratz from the UW Carbone Cancer Center. It's great to have him with us. And Connie in Madison has something for us, so let's go there. Hi, Connie. Oh, perhaps we lost that guest. Let's instead turn to Tom in Madison. Tom, hello.
Hello. Thank you, gentlemen, for the great show. I just had a question, and I've come in a little bit late on the program, but the role of the liquid biopsy in early pancreatic cancer detection. And I know locally here Exact Science has developed a test, and I wonder if moving forward, if that would be of any benefit. And of course, cost is always an issue, but I'd like your feedback on that thought.
Yeah, that's a great question. I would say that this time, the challenge is that we can detect a variety of things with liquid-based tests, and it really depends upon an individual's risk factors. I would say that the use of a liquid biopsy or the use of blood-based testing to screen for pancreas cancer is currently a research question. There have been no studies to date that have used those types of assays that have shown an improvement in survival. Now, are there individuals from those types of studies where we picked up variants that are shared or common in pancreas cancer, and they've been diagnosed earlier at the individual level? That certainly, you know, has been true. But in terms of randomization, where we've taken, you know, hundreds or thousands of individuals, provisioned them those tests, or established annual follow-up visits with their primary care doctor, those randomized studies, to the best of my knowledge, have not been performed. And so, you know, while this is an important area of research, and I believe there are more blood-based tests to screen for many cancers that are available through both Exact Sciences and GRAIL, The evidence base that those to date have been able to help patients live longer through early diagnosis, that data has not been generated thus far. And so I do think, you know, there has to be some caution because there are other downsides of doing those tests. Those tests will, if positive, necessitate the need for additional scans, additional procedures, additional clinic visits, additional healthcare cost. And so, you know, in terms of using them, outside of where they're indicated or using them for primary screening, I think individuals just need to be informed about the potential downsides of any test, including the ones developed for early detection. I think a lot of it relates to the sensitivity. While there are some cancer genes that we can detect in pancreas cancer that can be detected in the bloodstream, they can be seen for other conditions that are benign or may not confer any change in an individual's course across time. An example is a gene called TP53 that sometimes as we age can change some of the bone marrow cells and lead to a condition called clonal hematopoiesis of indeterminate potential, what we call it CHIP. And for example, if we were to pick that up in the bloodstream, while TP53 could be seen in pancreas cancer, it can be seen also as a function of spontaneous mutations in the bone marrow as a part of aging that may not change an individual's course. And so it's really important that we have kind of pathways where individuals can access care. And I know that for some of these newer screening-based tests, we're in discussions right now to find clinical services that can help meet our patients' needs within the community. I would say that as individual providers who treat pancreas cancer, we certainly are available and happy to connect with individuals and patients to provide them the best care. I would say that at this time, that probably should be done in coordination with the primary care physician, because I think the continuity in having that, I think the primary care physicians also should be providing some education back to patients about what the risks and benefits are of these novel diagnostic tools, and also the limitations. I think the limitations have to be clarified. Some patients, more information in that is very important. And that may be a reasonable consideration for other patients who, say, have many other health conditions or already have enough doctor appointments as it is, and the limitations of that should also be considered.
Yeah. And this probably relates to John in Fitchburg's email. He was wondering how good CancerGuard is. That's a new screening test. How good CancerGuard is at detecting pancreas cancer.
It's a great question. So I think, there's a couple different tests. I think the one that we know the most about, of course, is ColoGuard, which was a stool-based test to detect colon cancer. CancerGuard is a new blood-based multi-cancer early detection test that's available from Exact Sciences. It was launched specifically for individuals with no prior history of cancer, and it does have a variety of DNA and protein markers that are included in it to help kind of personalize the potential for cancer to develop. And so, again, these screening efforts, can be available, but I think that individuals should have a shared discussion with their personal physician, with their primary care physician, prior to ordering these tests, because they can result in additional follow-up imaging or invasive procedures. And the ability of these tests to improve survival, I think, is an active area of research right now.
Connie in Madison, what's on your mind?
Hi, Larry. I'm back. Thank you. I'm going to miss you so much. Thank you for doing this show. I was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer about 3 years ago, pretty close to when the pancreatic clinic opened at UW Hospital. And after my endoscopy, I was told within a week I should have my pancreas and spleen removed. And I was in shock and just kind of needed to meditate on it a little. And so I didn't go ahead with it. And I did, through my research, find that there was a Chinese study that women over 75, their tumors didn't continue to grow typically. And so I chose not to have the surgery. And I haven't had any kind of follow-up or any advice that there was a prevention clinic and any advice on building up your immune system or any of that. And I just wonder, why is it, if you choose not to get surgery, are you kind of no longer part of the program? Or and I'm still alive 3 years later, so
well, that's good.
I guess the Chinese know what they're talking about.
Yeah, I would be hesitant to provide, you know, formalized medical advice on, you know, without knowing more details about initial imaging, blood-based biomarkers, your clinical status, all of those things. What I would say is that there are some variants of pancreatic tumors that can be significantly more indolent. And those are the neuroendocrine or carcinoid-based tumors that generally have a slower clinical course. It's possible that is the type that maybe you could have. But that said, I think that providing that perspective via, you know, this call, I think would be premature. And I think there's a lot of factors that go into an individual's course that, you know, that have to be considered. And I think understanding, what do we see microscopically? What do we see on the scan? How has that changed across time? How are you doing? You know, how is your overall health? All of those factors play into the risk benefits of things like major surgery and the likes. And so, you know, while I'm glad that it sounds like things have been pretty stable overall, that's great news. But I would just, you know, heed some caution to say that, you know, there could be other explanations for that. And that's where continuity of care and having follow-up and established relationship with your primary care doctor and potentially a surgeon or a medical oncologist, I think that's where we provide, you know, the best care. I think in some ways, oncology is a profession where we get the privilege of having relationships with our patients. And that's something that we take extremely seriously in terms of our clinical practice.
Connie, thank you. And in our last minute, Bob had emailed wondering, are there cures on the horizon for phase four patients?
It's a great question. For individuals with metastatic disease, you know, there remain some challenges to achieve cure. You know, I think that we need better systemic treatments. And that's where the use of both agents that target the cancer, so the KRAS agents, as well as other growth factors that are unique to pancreas cancer, important. And then the other is the ability of the immune system to bring in contact these same targets so that we can allow for the immune system to kind of come alongside and clean up anything else that could be in the bloodstream. Right now, we know that chemotherapy alone is not a cure. You know, we think that chemotherapy can help patients live longer, but it comes at a cost of additional toxicity, low blood counts, infection risk, GI symptoms and the likes. And so we definitely need combination treatments, which is what we're working on in the lab.
Dr. Kratz, thank you so much for being with us today. We'll have him, hopefully we'll get him back and we can talk some more about pancreas cancer and the work of the center there at the UW. They're doing a lot of great work. And thank you for listening, and thanks to Clara Kniper, Joel Patna, Lee Rayburn, Jeff Robbins of our team, our executive producer, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller, and we ask you to stay with us. Lots more in store on WPR News.